The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, listeners across North America and around the world. You are about to embark on an hour-long journey of scientific self-discovery, of intriguingly introspective inquiry, and of course, cognitively creative conversation. Welcome to the show where we ask you to call in and question everything. Skeptically Speaking is starting right now.
Thanks, Sean. You realize, audience, that this is the high point of Sean's week. He gets to do that intro. You can tell by his voice.
I do get quite excited, yes.
So, hello, lovelies. Today's show is all about ethics in biotechnology. GM foods, gene patents, designer babies. Lots of topics that tend to fall into the morally ambiguous area. Fortunately, we will have a philosopher, author, and ethicist, Chris McDonald, with us, and he will help us sort it all out. But let's start the show off with a local skeptic speaking up about something near and dear to his heart. We have diehard, I say, Skeptically Speaking fan Nathan Hinman in the studio with us. Hi, Nathan.
Hello.
And he'll be talking about Skepticamp. So what is it?
Well, Skepticamp, it's a user-driven, community-based event that's based on the BarCamp format. Essentially, all the participants of the Skepticamp can have the opportunity to be presenters of events like presentations, roundtables, question and answer sessions. And the idea in this case is to have a skeptical bent to it. Basically, this event has been held successfully in a number of locations already around North America. Couple of locations like Columbus, Ohio, and Atlanta, Georgia. And I've been speaking with the event organizers there. They managed to pull them off quite successfully. It's also been discussed on blogs like Skeptic and podcasts like Skepticality. And as Swoopy on Skepticality says, one of the first things about Skepticamp is to talk about Skepticamp. So that's what I'm here, hopefully getting the word out for. Right now, we have got a Facebook group trying to gain or gauge interest in Skepticamp Alberta. And there is a spreadsheet, which was previously, I guess there was some confusion as to what the spreadsheet's purpose was. Essentially, it's a Google spreadsheet that we're just trying to get people to put their name down if they're interested in attending, or if they have a presentation idea, definitely put that down. Or if they're not sure what they want to present, but they want to do it anyways, put that down.
So you can attend without presenting?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Hopefully we have a few people who present. Otherwise, we're just going to be a bunch of skeptics hanging around for a day.
Like we do all the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's nothing wrong with that either.
Okay. So you're in the planning stages right now, though.
Absolutely.
So we don't have dates or anything at this point.
No, and that's part of the reason why we want to get people to be aware that we want to do this. Or, well, there's a few people who are interested in it, and we need people to put their names down, say, hey, I'm interested. That way we can get an idea of when we want to do
interest.
It. Exactly.
Okay. Sounds good. So, first of all, how can people get a hold of you if they want to attend or if they want to present?
Okay, well, they can find me on Facebook, Nathan Hinman. They can also put their name on the spreadsheet, which I'll make sure Sean has a link to put in the post show notes for today. Or they can even email me at nhinman@shaw.ca.
You are very open with your information.
I am.
That's the world teacher. So what if people are thinking about doing something like this in their own communities?
Well,
would you suggest they go?
Well, I've actually gotten a lot of good information from other event organizers like Maria and Jen from Skeptic and Healthy Attic from YouTube. They've mentioned going to the local college or university, free thinkers or atheist agnostic group to inquire about booking event venues, places to have it. Apparently, colleges and universities are actually a really good place to get a lot of this interest.
Okay. Well, I think that's it. Thank you very much, Nathan, for
Thank you.
Being here. And I believe we'll be right back with Chris McDonald and Biotech Ethics right after this commercial. Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time at 780-492-2577 extension 1. That's 780-492-2577 extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Skeptically Speaking is also rebroadcast on Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show. All right, well, welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be talking about ethics in biotechnology. We're on the line with Chris McDonald. He teaches philosophy, specifically ethics and critical thinking, at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And for you Americans, that's in Canada. He was the co-author of The Power of Critical Thinking, and he's been writing the popular blog Business Ethics for 3 years. He's also currently hard at work on a book, and I believe he's at a bioethics conference right now. Is that correct, Chris?
That's right. I'm in lovely downtown Hamilton, Ontario.
Lovely. And so we're especially pleased to have him take time out to be with us. So welcome, Chris.
Thanks.
So listeners, Chris is here to talk about the ethics side, not the science side. So no questions about the technical intricacies, please. Otherwise, you'll just embarrass us. Chris, on your blog, mainly you focus on businesses' ethical obligations.
That's right.
So when did you start the sublog just devoted to biotech?
I actually only started that one a few months ago. I've had a you know, obviously an interest in ethical issues in biotech for quite a few years, but I hadn't really thought to start a blog, basically because I sort of figured that there would be other good biotech ethics blogs out there, and so I thought I didn't need to do it. But then I looked around a bit and I figured out that there weren't as many as I thought, or not ones that covered the same range. There are ones sort of on stem cells and there are ones on genetic testing. There wasn't the full range of biotech ethics issues. And I also partly, frankly, started it for the selfish reason of I just wanted a place to be able to post stuff as sort of an advanced form of bookmarking so I could come back to it later on.
Right, because you had written about biotech issues on your main blog for quite a while.
Sure, yeah, because the, though most of my research interest is in business ethics, the particular industry that I'm most interested in is the biotech industry. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the blog entries tend to be sort of along the edges of the biotech industry.
So has there been an increase in biotech ethical related issues lately, or?
I don't know if there's been an increase overall. I mean, ever since they cloned that darn sheep back in the late 90s, the interest has been pretty solid. Dolly has been good for business. So it seems to, you know, come and go a bit. And lately, of course, the big topic has been personal genomics and direct to consumer genetic testing. Mm-hmm. So you've seen sort of a flurry of stuff about that in the last 6 months or year. But I'm not sure whether it's there's been much of an increase overall.
Okay, well, what kind of things, for our audience, what kind of things fall into the sort of biotech umbrella?
Biotech's actually a controversial term to a certain extent, because it's not clear exactly what counts. I mean, basically, biotech is anytime you're using a living organism or a part or a derivative of a living organism to do some useful for some useful purpose, you're doing a kind of biotechnology. So, for example, technically speaking, making beer is biotechnology because you're using yeast.
Right.
You're using a living organism to produce a sort of to carry out what is, in a sense, an industrial process. The same with making beer or wine, some of our favorite industrial processes, beer, wine, bread. But that's not what anybody means when they talk about biotech. Usually what they mean is a process that uses sort of laboratory-based genetic manipulation, things like recombinant DNA technology to manipulate organisms, often microbes, sometimes larger organisms, to suit human purposes.
Okay, now, callers, if you want to get in on this phone conversation, do call 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio.
Sorry, I was just going to say, the other thing to add, just in terms of defining biotechnology, is that for a lot of people don't realize the sort of range of things that fall under the heading. And just to give you a quick example, a lot of people tend to think in terms of human health biotechnology. So they think of reproductive cloning, or they think of stem cells, or they think of genetic testing. Some people will think also of agricultural biotechnology, sort of genetically modified foods. Mm-hmm. The other big category that almost nobody talks about is industrial biotechnology, which is the use of, in particular, genetically modified microbes and so on, or enzymes derived from those in industrial processes. So whether it's bio-leaching in the mining industry, or bio-remediation in the to clean up oil spills,
right,
or whether it's the use of enzymes derived from genetically modified microbes to soften fibers for use in clothing. Those are all examples of biotechnology too, but they're very far from the sort of human health technologies that usually come to mind when people talk about biotech. So it's a much broader field than people are sometimes aware of.
It absolutely is, and that's why I asked that question, because before starting to research for this show, I had a very definite picture of what biotech was in my mind. But I can honestly say I have read more for this show than any other show so far, just because I couldn't stop reading. There's so many things that fall into this category that nobody even thinks about. So on that note, we have a lot to talk about. So how about, let's start with the gene patents. I keep hearing the statement lately, actually, that 20% of our genes are patented. So what does that mean?
Well, I mean, basically what it means is, first thing to say is, well, it's controversial what it means. For one thing, the number of genes that we think we have, scientists keep revising that number somewhat, so we don't have quite as many genes as it was once estimated humans have. So to say that it's 20% means it's 20% of the number of genes we currently estimate are in the human genome. And basically, to say that a gene is patented, again, that it basically gives a kind of intellectual property, right, which is a kind of property right, a kind of legal right to control what happens to a piece of information. Basically, what it means is that the individual, or more typically a company that owns the patent on a gene, is going to have some legal right to control basically the kinds of products that can be sold, or the kinds of uses that a particular genetic sequence can be put to.
So would that affect the research that could be done on those genes then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the very least, if I own, so for example, if I own a patent on a particular gene, and it's a particular gene that's a mutation related to a particular cancer, what that means is that anybody else who sort of does research on that gene and finds a treatment for that cancer that's based on that genetic sequence is going to have an awful lot of trouble commercializing that knowledge. So they're going to have trouble, for one thing, attracting investors. Drug development's a very expensive process. And if somebody else already holds a patent on that gene, there's not much prospect, or you're going to have to, at the very least, negotiate some pretty serious licensing fees to be able to get your science turned into a marketable product.
Well, see, that to me seems unethical, one would say, to restrict, like, potentially life-saving research.
Yeah, well, the part of the problem, and one of the things that you got to see is that, you know, I mean, certainly there are problems. Certainly there are worries about this. The problem is coming up with the right balance, right? I mean, almost nobody thinks, or at least nobody who's thought about it clearly should think that patents on, well, genes or anything else are entirely a crazy idea, and probably nobody should think that they're entirely a wonderful idea either, because you got to think about what it is that a patenting regime or any kind of intellectual property regime, whether it's copyright on a book or a copyright on the things I write on my blog, you have to remember what you're trying to do with intellectual property protection is two things, right? So there's two very different kinds of arguments people have in terms of why we should allow patenting of anything. One is sort of a basic fairness argument, right? So if I work on something hard, I spend all day, well, I don't spend all day laboring on a blog entry, but say I spend a few hours laboring on a blog entry, you shouldn't be able to just take that information, that writing, take my name off it and post it on your own blog. That would be unfair to me.
Agreed.
Right? The second thing is sort of a consequentialist or an outcomes-based argument, which says, look, why on earth would anyone ever build anything good? Why would anyone build anything useful if somebody could just come along the next day and steal it? Right? Now, a certain percentage of people will just sort of build things for the pure fun of being creative and just for out of generosity.
Yeah, open source software is a
sure,
is
sure, an and there and there are certainly cases where that can work, but it's there's reason to be skeptical about it as sort of a generalizable. Certainly, if property weren't protected in general, right? I mean, if mm-hmm. houses, think of real property, if houses weren't protected from theft, nobody would build one, right? It would be stupid to build a house if someone could just come along the next day and say, I would like this. This is mine now. So by analogy, right, it would be very difficult to convince people to invest millions of dollars in investing in new, you know, cures or treatments for diseases if there was going to be no reasonable chance of making a profit on it at the end of the day, right?
Yeah,
there'd be a few charitable organizations that would do it, but you wouldn't get massive investment. So there are these sort of initial arguments, and those arguments don't mean that just sort of, you know, as much patent protection as possible till the end of time. But what they mean is, look, there's a sort of a public policy objective being sought here, and what you want to figure out is, well, how much patent protection, right? Not whether there should be any patent protection, but you know, do we want patents to last 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years? Right? Do we want patents to come with a clause that says, well, you know, if you own the patent on something and you don't actually make use of it, you don't actually commercialize a product, then you kind of have to let other people license it. For example, you can't just hoard it.
Right.
So those are the kinds of details that you want to be thinking through, and it's a very tricky kind of public policy ethical question.
Well, there is a suit right now. There's patents on two genes linked to breast and ovarian cancer, and that patent is being challenged in court by the ACLU. And they're arguing that patenting pure genes is unconstitutional and hinders research.
The constitutionality thing, well, it's the U.S. Constitution, so I don't really have much much expertise on that. So it's an interesting point. Certainly, if that lawsuit succeeds, it's going to be, I think the informed observers have said that it's going to be a game changer. It'll just change the way investment happens in biotech because, there is this argument that says, look, independent of, right, admittedly, we want to protect people's intellectual contributions in principle, and admittedly, we want to reward hard work and that sort of thing. But for a lot of people, anyway, there's this moral objection that says, look, living things or pieces of living things just shouldn't be the kind of thing that you can patent and sell. Sort of analogously, or, you know, in a way that's analogous to the fact that we think that there are certain things that, you know, or that most people think shouldn't be available for sale, right? Like, you
right.
can't sell children, for example, right? As much as we believe in the free market, most people think it's bad to sell children. A large percentage of the population at least thinks it's bad to sell sex. So there's a bunch of things that we say, you know, you just can't sell those things. And so similarly, some people say, well, there's certain things you just shouldn't be able to patent. The other argument, in a way, is a little more, is more interesting, which is the idea and that by patenting, by allowing patents over genes, even though we've intended to stimulate research, what we've in fact done is in some ways hinder research, precisely for that reason I initially cited, which is that if you own a patent on a gene, I'm not going to bother trying to do research on that gene research on diseases that are related to that gene, or maybe even research on diseases that might potentially be related to that gene, because right. It might end up being a waste of time, right? So, and in part, this is an empirical question, right? How has it actually gone is an empirical question, right? You want to know, well, how have scientists and biotech companies actually responded? How have they actually operated in the face of this? And I take it that the claim being made by the ACLU and others is that as a matter of fact, not as a matter of principle, well, there's the principled argument about the constitutionality, but as a matter of fact, they're claiming patents per se or patents of the particular style that we currently allow are doing more harm than good to scientific enterprise, basically. And
that's a hard question.
It's an awfully hard thing to figure out, right? How, you know, so if, you know, Myriad Genetics owns the patent on BRCA1 and 2, a couple of genes related to breast cancer, it's a very hard counterfactual question to ask, well, how would researchers have behaved over the last 10 years if they didn't have that patent, if Myriad didn't have that patent? That's pretty hard to figure out, right?
That's so it's an interesting question.
It's going to be a hard question for the courts to figure out. What the actual impact is, because you've got to figure out what would have happened if things had been different.
Callers, you can reach us at 492-2577, extension 1. Oh, I'm sorry. I should give the area code. 780-492-2577, extension 1, or by email, live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or on Twitter, we are Skeptical Radio. So let's actually move on to personal genomics. Is it genomics or genomics?
Tomato, tomato.
God, it's like a Linux, Linux thing. Okay. So I keep seeing that phrase. So what actually does that mean?
Another good question. That's basically, there's the terminology is kind of all over the map. Basically, personal genomics companies, I mean, as far as I can tell, it's not a clearly defined scientific term, so it's not like you can go and look it up in the in some authoritative place and just find out what the textbook answer is. But basically, personal genomics companies are companies that are interested in selling genetic tests to individuals to tell them about their own genetic characteristics, either susceptibility to various diseases or, in some cases, whether they have genes related to particular physical traits that aren't necessarily disease-related.
Right. So it's... Does this mean necessarily like direct-to-consumer testing?
That's a good question. I have to think about whether not necessarily direct-to-consumer, because I think most companies that rely on I think that if a company made you go through a physician to access their services, they could still call themselves a personal genomics company, because they're still selling a particular kind of product, right, which is they're going to tell you about you, so it's personal in that sense.
And right now, if I'm correct, there's no legislation anywhere around the fact that you have to get this through your doctor. You can just send away for it.
Yeah, certainly in North America, I wouldn't say any legislation anywhere, because I think there were some recent restrictions in Germany, for example, and other things going on in the European Union that I'm not positive about. But certainly in Canada or the U.S., it's to the best of my knowledge, unless some state has passed something very recently, basically it's legal to sell personal genomics or genomics, if you want, direct to consumers. And the two big direct to consumer actually in this context has two different meanings. One is about selling direct to consumers. The other is about advertising direct to consumers. And you can tease those apart, because on the one hand, there are companies that say, you know, that'll put ads on the internet that say, you know, come to us for all your genetic testing needs, you know, spit in a tube and send it to us and we'll send you results. Well, that's roughly
internet
what it is.
Internet is a fascinating place.
Yeah. Isn't the internet wonderful? And then there are other companies that say, well, they're going to advertise directly. So, you know, we'll put an ad in the paper that says, if you want to find out about your risk for breast cancer, talk to your doctor and get your doctor to prescribe to send us the order. And then it's still direct to consumer in the sense that other pharmaceutical products are advertised direct to consumer, but you still have to go through a physician to get them.
Right. For $48,000, you can have your DNA analyzed via whole genome sequencing. That was all over the internet a couple of days ago.
Yeah, apparently, yeah, you can get the whole shebang done. There've been lots of companies offering bits and pieces from a single gene to hundreds of genetic markers for between a couple hundred and a few thousand dollars. But yeah, the price is dropping, and that's probably one of the reasons you're seeing a bit more of this, is that as the technology improves, it gets cheaper, simpler and cheaper to do this, and you're going to see more and more companies with the technical capacity to do it offering it, and the internet makes it awfully simple to, you know, once you've got the lab, anybody can offer a service, right? Because, in fact, you can offer it internationally,
so,
via the internet.
So do you think we'll ever get to the point where it could be so commoditized that it's, you know, the next Starbucks, you can go to the corner DNA tester?
I was thinking it would be an iPhone app, actually.
That's right, you spit in the end of your iPhone.
Exactly.
Yeah. A little accessory for that one, sure.
I guess, absent any new regulations, it might well get to that point. It's not clear. I mean, all of this, of course, is driven by, you know, like any other product, is driven by consumer interest, right? Or the ability of companies to generate interest on the part of consumers. And part of the reason, in fact, the main reason why Starbucks is so common is that people like coffee an awful lot and are willing to spend money on it every single day. So far, the market for personal genomics looks to be pretty small.
Right.
I know lots of people who are interested in genomics, but I don't know very many people who have signed up for 23andMe, for example.
Right.
Well, some, but not many.
And I do actually want to talk about 23andMe a little bit later.
And I guess it's not one of those things you'd go back for every week once you've analyzed your DNA. It's
not
changing.
Yeah, to a certain extent, that's right. I mean, what some of these companies do, you're certainly not necessarily going to get tested multiple times. But what you might do is go back for new interpretations as new evidence becomes available, right?
Ah.
So we don't yet know where the gene for, you know, disease X is, but so you're going to get genetically tested for a bunch of things this week, but we're not going to test for disease X because we don't know how. But 5 years later, when that gene is discovered, you know, now we've got something to sell you again.
So, you know, there's two sides of the spectrum here. On one side, we have, you know, testing for predisposition to various diseases. But on the other hand, we have things like, you know, designer babies that everybody keeps talking about. So let's talk about the former, first of all. So for testing for something like breast cancer is a good thing. I think we can all agree on that. But it's been said that maybe these tests aren't as valuable as they're marketing themselves to be.
Yeah, there's an issue of sort of scientific validity, or not so much scientific validity, but power, really. So the main breast cancer genes that we know about, BRCA1 and 2, the ones that Myriad has the patent on, are relatively important genes, right? So if you have one of those genes, if you carry one of those mutations, it raises, I forget the numbers exactly, but it raises your risk of breast cancer pretty substantially. It doesn't mean you will get breast cancer. And if you don't have those genes, it certainly doesn't mean that you won't get breast cancer. But these are clinically important genes, right? If your doctor knew that you carried one of those genes, they would, you know, probably manage your health care differently and tell you to watch for, you know, have mammograms more often, things like that. But what some of the companies are selling, and what most of these personal genomics companies are selling, are basically more vague genetic markers, not full genes, right? They're looking for genetic indicators that are statistically correlated with certain disease states, right? So they do these what they call genome-wide association studies, and I'm not a scientist, so I won't attempt to go too much into the details. But basically, what they do is they look at large populations and try and find anything in a genome that is at least a little bit correlated with a particular disease. Now, correlation doesn't imply causation. And some of these associations are pretty weak. So, for example, you know, I go for information on genomics, I go to the same place that I go to for information on homeopathy, which is, like, you know, talk to scientists, since I'm not one. And the last time I heard a bunch of geneticists talking about personal genomics, they basically said this was entertainment value because there was not enough power in most of these services and, or in the statistical correlations that these services offer to really be able to tell you what you should do. You know. So if, right. if they told you that you had a 1% greater than population chance of developing a disease, well, what are you going to do about it? There's only, especially if it's a disease, you know, that is somewhat common in the population. Are you going to change your lifestyle radically? Well, probably not.
Well, additionally, anyway. The problem with this is that even, you know, if your doctor is ordering these kind of tests for you, sometimes the doctors don't actually know how to read the results of these tests. They're
yeah, the kinds of tests that are sold by the personal genomics companies, for the most part, doctors wouldn't order them because they're just not clinically useful.
Right.
Right. There's just not a it's not a clear enough indicator that you're at risk. But yeah, that's really the other part of the problem is that genetics is complicated enough and that. You know, med school is only a few years long, and there's only so much stuff you can fit into the curriculum. And most family practitioners, most general family doctors at this point, don't understand. And this is not to blame family physicians.
No, they just haven't been
highly trained. There's just only so much genetics in their curriculum, even in 2009, and so they often aren't going to fully understand. Either the results of one of these tests or the implications of one of those tests in terms of what they imply for, you know, for the health of their patients.
So even if by some chance, you know, these tests were accurate and you could do something positive with that information and your doctor understood, there are definitely downsides. Actually, researchers at the University of Alberta did a study on respondents who said they had experienced discrimination because of their genetic risk, discrimination in terms of life insurance, long-term disability, mortgage insurance. So this is not necessarily information you want out in the public sphere anyway.
Right, yeah. One of the first things I'll just point out while I've got my critical thinking hat on is that that study, yeah, that's a hat that I never remove. It's an occupational hazard. At least from the news reports of that study, I mean, you're talking about self-reporting of discrimination, right? So
right.
It's a little hard to, it's not that those kinds of reports aren't valid. It's, you know, it's not that we don't pay heed when people feel they've been discriminated against, but a research study that's based on people's reporting of their own subjective experience of discrimination doesn't necessarily
exactly.
tell us, you know, people report a lot of experiences and they're not all necessarily good indicators of what goes on in the world.
Right, but this is a possibility.
But certainly there's the possibility and the likelihood that some genetic discrimination is going on. And that's the other side of the worry about people understanding the data, or not is understanding the implications of the test, right? Is on the one hand, they may not understand the technical data. In fact, they're very unlikely to understand fully the technical implications or the health implications of a genetic test result. But the other thing they're not necessarily going to understand, and in fact, pretty unlikely to understand, is what are the social and economic risks of this piece of information. In terms of how likely is it that I'm going to be subject to discrimination, either in hiring or in insurance, for example.
Right. Now, you mentioned something previously, and I do want to talk about it. 23andMe. I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, 23andMe is one of the personal genomics companies, right? They're a company that, in fact, they're sort of the in some sense, I don't know in terms of dollars or sales, but they're arguably the leading personal genomics company in the world. Seem to have the biggest customer base, and they've got the economic might of Google behind them because I think one of the co-founders is the wife of one of the co-founders of Google. So, and Google's one of their investors.
So how does that system work?
Yeah, well, basically, it is sort of a standard personal genomics company. You basically go onto their website, read a whole bunch of stuff, order their kit. They send you a kit by mail, maybe by courier, and it includes a test tube. And you spit in the test tube, and then you
there's a lot of spitting it. Going on.
There's a
on
lot
this.
Of spitting. Some companies I think do cheek swabs with a Q-tip kind of thing.
It's
but basically,
graceful.
you've got to get them some sample of your DNA. I think some companies you can actually do a blood sample too. You can go to a lab and have the lab draw blood, but basically spit will do. So you send the spit sample back to 23andMe, and I think a couple of weeks later, they send you the results. They send you either, I forget with 23andMe, whether they do it all digitally or whether they actually send you it on paper. But they send you a bunch of information that says, here's what we found out about you. Here are the genetic markers that we found that are, again, related in some statistical way, at least, to various disease states, whether anything from, you know, intestinal problems through to heart disease through to tendency towards various cancers.
Okay, we are going to go to a commercial. Chris, do stay on the line.
Okay,
we're not
sure.
Done with you. And we'll be right back after the break. On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about astronomy with popular author and super blogger, Phil Plait. And as usual, we have a lot of questions. Like, why is Pluto now not a planet? What's NASA up to lately? And what is the deal with the Hubble telescope? How do we know we really landed on the moon? Is it likely that we'll all be killed by asteroids, comets, black holes, or supernova? Like in the Star Trek movie. When Spock explains the plot to the audience when he's mind-melding with Kirk, he talks about that supernova, the one that threatened the galaxy. Can that happen? The supernova part, not the mind-meld. Ask away on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, here on CJSR.
And we're back, everybody. This is Skeptically Speaking. Again, 492-2577 extension 1.
You almost forgot.
The area code? No, I was like, I should have said the 780. We do have it on the wall if I ever need to use the cheat sheet. Live at skepticallyspeaking.com or Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Just before we maybe move on to the next topic here, I kind of had a little thought with my little... you know, Starbucks-esque genetic testing. I kind of worry about the potential for some woo to get into the industry, you know, get your genetic test and we'll determine your fate because your DNA aligns a certain way.
Oh, Lord.
I think this could potentially open the door for a whole realm of some pseudosciences. And
Chris, has this happened that you've heard?
I think this thing... kind of, it's not exactly that, but there's, in a way, there is something, I do get the sense that there's some sort of connection, or some sort of, I don't want to say connection, I guess connection in spirit, at least in part between, in the rhetoric, right? Because a lot of the rhetoric around personal genomics is about empowerment and about people taking control of their own health, which sounds... you know, kind of reminiscent of some of the stuff you get around holistic medicine, right? That, you know, that what we're selling you here is an opportunity to participate in your own health care, and it's about empowerment, and it's about, you know, giving you what you need. It's not old-fashioned medicine, it's this new stuff. And, you know, clearly there are big, big differences between the two, right? I mean, personal genomics, even at its, you know, even... might be a weak product, but it is a science-based product. These are not, you know, this isn't false stuff. It's just stuff where the usefulness of it is where the usefulness of these correlations is not, it's not clear yet. And they probably will get more potent. But yeah, this part of the sales pitch certainly I think is kind of the same, which is worrisome.
Well, you say, you know, it is science-based, and I agree, it absolutely is. But look at something like, you know, quantum physics. That word has been raked over the coals by people
sure.
who have no right to it. So we do worry about stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I think part of the, you know, at least some people worry rightly, I think that you know, we're getting to the point where as soon as you attach the word DNA to it, or the acronym DNA, or the word genetic to it, it's going to sound better, right? So one of the very first personal genomics product I bumped into was at a Shoppers Drug Mart in downtown Toronto, and I came across this DNA dermal, I think it's called dermal DNA, DNA something, that does a test that has to do with how susceptible your skin will be genetically to being damaged by the sun's rays. Right? They have scientific studies that apparently establish that certain genetic markers are associated with you being more likely to get damaged by the sun. And we all know that, you know, there is, you know, UV rays hurt your skin and can cause skin cancers. But then, of course, part two of the genetic test is once you get the genetic test, they'll sell you the skin cream to help keep your skin young and pretty forever, kind of thing.
And so it begins. We actually have a caller on the line.
Yes, we do. Are you there, caller?
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 Oh, I don't know where that
is. Interesting.
Well, we also have an email
question.
How about
this one? Nathan, are you there? Nope. Okay. That's a little odd. Well, we'll go to the email. I have it right next to me here. Let's see. What do you think is the most controversial research currently going on in biotech?
That's a good question.
The most controversial. Most controversial. I assume the question means sort of most actually worrisome. I mean, the most controversial might be, you know, in the U.S. anyway, stem cells, just because there's so much controversy. That doesn't mean there's, you know, good controversy or useful controversy, but it's clearly the most controversial. If the question is the most dubious or the most worrisome, wow, that's a good question.
Thank you, emailer.
I suppose anything that has to do with work on sort of biological warfare, or anything like that. I mean, those are any sort of dual use research, things that, you know, I mean, there's good reason why we want to understand really, really well how, you know, really horrible things like anthrax. We want to understand them really well. We want to understand their, you know, how easily or with how much difficulty they can be turned into weapons, things like that. But that kind of research is a double-edged sword, right? Almost literally, which is that, you know, you worry that anyone who's doing research into how to protect us from that stuff is also learning a lot of information that in the wrong hands could be used to hurt people. So that kind of research is certainly, I'm not sure if maybe controversial is not the right word, but it's certainly one where you want to make sure there are really careful safeguards and really clear sort of governance structures in place to make that sure that kind of work is done safely.
All right, I think we have that caller back on the line.
All right, there, Nathan.
I'm here.
Perfect.
So, I guess what I was really wondering was the odds of actually having like a society like they portray in the movie Gattaca, where everything you do is based strictly on whether or not you pass their genetic tests, and just what the ethical ramifications of such a society would be.
I knew we were going to get science fiction-y any second.
It cannot be avoided on this show.
Yeah, so if I think those are, I mean, science fiction is great for its ability to show us sort of, you know, what might be, hopefully what's relatively unlikely in the case of Gattaca. I mean, certainly you probably wouldn't have thought even when Gattaca came out that we would be as close as we now are to having the kind of technology, right? I mean, if you remember there were scenes in Gattaca where the, you know, after hours, after employees had left work, the cleaning crews would come around, except they weren't really cleaning crews, they were DNA testing crews, and they would test your keyboard to make sure you were really you and check your genetic profile again, I guess. And that seemed pretty crazy at the time, but, you know, the price of genetic testing is dropping so rapidly that you probably could do that. Fortunately, I guess, people are paranoid enough, and I mean paranoid in the best, in the endearing sense, paranoid enough about genetic technologies that we do have a certain amount of legal protections being put in place. I mean, the U.S. now has a Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which is, you know, not a perfect piece of legislation from what I understand, but it does you know, put into law that there are certain, you can't discriminate against people based on their genetic profile, at least in certain sort of employment and insurance-related contexts. So in order for Gattaca to come true, two things have to happen, right? The technology has to get better or scarier, depending on how you look at it, on the one hand. And the other thing that has to happen is that society has to sort of fall asleep at the switch, right? We have to, you know, ignore the risks. I sort of think that the latter is implausible at this point in terms of entirely falling asleep at the switch. I mean, there's an awful lot of healthy debate, and I think there are risks of things like discrimination. We haven't seen a lot of it yet, and I guess the question is whether we'll be able to, you know, there will be presumably injustices, you know, with any new technology. It takes a while for appropriate protections to be put in place sometimes. And I suspect what we're going to see is that there are going to be some lamentable cases happen, some true injustices and maybe some people hurt along the way before we put proper safeguards in place, partly because we won't know exactly what safeguards we need until we see a few people treated badly, unfortunately.
Thanks very much, Nathan.
Thank you, Nathan. Okay. It kind of reminds me of the internet. You know, we've had it about 15 years, 20 years already. I don't know. A long time the internet's been around, and we're still trying to figure all this out legally in a lot of cases.
Yes, that's right. In some cases, it's just very difficult to foresee, you know, exactly where the risks are going to be. So, for example, you know, people are worried about genetic discrimination in insurance, but, you know, with regard to personal genomics. But if I had to, and this is sort of an off-the-cuff, you know, semi-informed guess, but I'd guess that genetic testing for paternity is the most dangerous kind of genetic testing, direct-to-consumer genetic testing, because we know that people can be hurt by that. We know that families can be torn apart by paternity testing. It's not so clear that people can be torn apart by being, you know, that people can really be hurt by being told they have a 1% greater chance of developing heart disease in their lifetime. So it's not always obvious where the risks are going to come from.
Well, you know, speaking of risks, let's use our last 12 minutes, I think we're at here, for genetically modified crops. And I held this right till the end, because if we're going to get any angry calls, it's going to be now.
Bring them on, callers. Bring them on.
So, obviously, extremely contentious issue. On one side of the coin, you have the possibility of feeding more people than we ever thought possible, in a time when we definitely really need to do that. But on the other side, you have things like Monsanto and Terminator genes. And for those who haven't heard of this, the Terminator gene is a specific genetic sequence that's inserted into a seed's DNA, and it renders the seed and the crop it produces sterile. So it's single use only, and from what I understand, this is a huge problem for communities all over the world that traditionally save their best seed from one year to use in next year's planting. So what do you think, Chris?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that, to the best of my knowledge, it's not currently in use. It's certainly technically feasible. It can be done, but to the best of my, it's not an issue. It's not one of the issues I've related to GM foods that I've spent a lot of time working on. But to the best of my knowledge, it can be done, but it's not currently being done, precisely because there was so much controversy and so much worry about it.
We do have a caller here as well.
Who,
Kevin,
I will warn you, actually called in immediately after I said angry calls.
It might have been after my taunt. One of the two. We'll share the credit.
So, Kevin, are you there?
Yeah, actually, I was phoning in before you said, as you were I was dialing as you said
that. Okay, so no anger. Okay.
And yeah. No credit.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do know of some pseudoscience and kind of genetic testing. Kind of like the lowest level genetic testing is blood type. And I've heard of both blood type diet and blood type find your mate.
It's big in Japan, I think.
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah, that's right. That is sort of a basic kind of genetic testing, and it's, yeah. I mean, certainly. I mean, just the way the world works and the way people seek out opportunities to profit from people who don't know any better. It's entirely predictable that, you know, the next 5 years we'll see, you know, people will, as this sort of technology, you know, 10 years ago, there were only a handful of labs in the world that could really, you know, do genetic testing. Now there are, I wouldn't even hazard to guess how many companies, how many labs there are. And once you get to the point where, I mean, certainly it's possible, like today, for people to just lie, right? You could just say, send us your spit sample and we'll tell you, you know, whether your chakras are, you know, blocked, whatever. But that would just be sort of outright, you know, scamming. But certainly there's all kinds of room for all kinds of people to operate in slightly grayer zones where they're, you know, telling you information or, you know, doing a genetic, they may well be doing an actual genetic test, but, you know, the kinds of advice that they're giving you may or may not have anything to do with, you know, anything rooted in science. You know, tell us, you know, we'll send you the right, you know, just the right homeopathic therapy for your, you know, particular genetic predispositions or something.
Thanks so much, caller. That was good information.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep going on GM. Now, okay, so Terminator technology is not in use, but this is something that they're definitely talking about putting into place.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's you can sort of understand why companies would be interested in this, right? Because what you don't want, one of the problems with living things as a product is that they have this habit of reproducing. So you sell someone, a watermelon, and in principle, they can either come back to you next year to buy another watermelon, or they can just save the seeds and plant a whole bunch of watermelons and never buy any from you again.
Right.
And so it's certainly, you know, in the company's apparent interest anyway, to find a way to say, look, no, what we're selling you is, we're selling you this, you know, a product for you to use right now, not a way for you to sort of pull the rug out from under us next year. But that, of course, is at odds with all kinds of, you know, traditional practices in agriculture, where saving seeds from year to year is exactly what farmers did, and that's how they, you know, you would buy some seeds, you would plant them, and then you'd, you know, save some of the resulting crop to plant next year, sort of the same way that you would, you know, if you bought two goats and you would, you know, breed them, and you would then start a line of breeding. You wouldn't have to go back to the guy you bought the goats from.
No, it's
every
creating
year,
a sustainable, right? Process, definitely.
Right. Yeah. So it's like in a sense, it's like a different understanding of, you know, a different sort of social norm about what the expectation is for how this, you know, what it is that you're buying, right? Are you buying a lineage, or are you buying something to eat? Right, you know, something to eat or something to grow,
right,
this year.
But that to me is one of the issues, because if you're, for example, let's say you have these, you know, super powered seeds and they have like four times the yield of regular seeds, but they also come with the Monsanto gene. So you have one farm that buys the Monsanto superpower ones, and then the other ones use regular seeds. Now, it's very likely that the company that chose to go with the, you know, self-renewing seeds could be out of business by the time,
right,
that it, like, these are the issues that I'm talking about.
Right, yeah. So they're essentially being driven out of business by what looks to be a superior product.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so, you know, people that can afford to buy those seeds and get the, you know, four times, five times the yield are definitely going to go in that direction, assuming, yeah, that they can raise enough money during that harvest to buy seeds the next year.
That's right. And if people are understanding, it's, you know, for any version, for any of the happy versions of this story, if indeed a happy version can be told, for any happy version to come true, it's got to rely on farmers actually understanding what they're getting, right? Nobody can defend selling things to farmers that, you know, where they don't understand what they're getting. Right, that's just,
yeah,
not,
you
know, the most hardcore defender of, you know, free market capitalism isn't going to say, oh, sure, you know, lie to them, it's all fine. So if they understand what they're getting, then hopefully they're going to make smart decisions about what, you know, what's the right investment for them. And for some, some won't be able to afford more expensive seeds.
Mm-hmm.
The question then becomes whether there's reason to think that old-fashioned seed production will be some way or another driven out of existence entirely, right? So would the, you know, will the Ferrari makers of the world be able to drive the economy car makers of the world out of business somehow? That's probably a bad analogy.
No, but I understand.
I have another question in regards to the Terminator gene. Now, there's often a concern from people that, you know, we might not predict what these crops are able to do. There might be some unforeseen forecast consequence of them, you know, running amok, you know, spreading crazily, yeah. And then, you know, 10 years later, there's some problem we didn't anticipate. Is the Terminator gene also considered kind of a safety mechanism in terms of perhaps preventing some of those unforeseen consequences, if there are to be any?
Yeah, that's at least one of the, you know, who knows exactly what, I don't know what exactly what the scientists involved had in mind when they developed it, but it's certainly one of the things that said about the Terminator gene was that, you know, people said, you know, when the idea of genetically modified crops being, you know, essentially released out into the, you know, outside of greenhouses, people were pretty worried about, well, what happens if these spread? So one kind of response is, okay, well, we'll engineer them so that they can't possibly spread, right? We'll engineer them so that they're sterile. And then either intentionally or by happy accident from the company's points of view, you know, it became obvious that, well, you know, farmers rely pretty heavily, or at least in some traditional practices, farmers rely pretty heavily on that ability to reproduce. So, yeah, there's kind of a, it's kind of a, from one perspective, it's a safety mechanism that has this unanticipated or consequence that's unconnected to its role as a safety mechanism.
Okay.
And so the question is, you know, whether there are other kinds of safety mechanisms that could be engineered that would be both, you know, economically viable for the seed company and economically viable for the farmers.
Now, we have very little time, and if anybody could see how I look in the studio, I have all these papers spread around, and I haven't even gotten to anything. I haven't made a dent in this. So the one thing I'm going to ask you about, what's the book you're writing about?
It's on business ethics in the biotechnology industry. So it's
brilliant.
Biotechnology ethics, but specifically the questions that are faced by companies, by, you know, people who are not just trying to develop new science, but trying to turn it into products.
Interesting. So, audience, when he finishes writing it, go buy his book.
You can find it on the blog, probably.
Absolutely. And you can also, you know, for you tweeters, he's at EthicsBlogger, and he's lovely. He has lots of good information that he posts. So that's all the time we have today. I would have loved to have got into, you know, ethics of stem cells, cloning, industrial biotech.
So much fun stuff.
So much other stuff. But yes. As always, an hour is never enough. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, Chris, for being with us.
My pleasure.
We do appreciate it. Thank you.
And thanks to Nathan for the Skepticamp info. Thanks to Ryan for doing phones. Thanks to Sean, as always, for pushing the buttons so I don't have to.
And we brought a new staff member on our team as well, Mike. We should give him a shout-out as well.
Absolutely. You'll hear next week about what he'll be doing with the show. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we will talk to you again next week on Skeptically Speaking.
We'll see you then, everyone. Have a good night.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working.